Sorry, everything's falling down.
Is everything okay there, Katie?
I built myself a little pillow fort, as always, and it's sort of collapsed. That sound you hear is my bicycle being used to prop everything up. Okay, we're good. Hello, Dominic.
It sounds very precarious. Hi, nice to be back. We've got a totally regular episode this week.
Yay.
Yeah, although it doesn't feel that regular because Katie and I actually spent some time together this week, so...
I know, weird. We were in Brussels doing some interviews and sharing a quite bland sandwich.
And it was actually surprisingly nice seeing you. You weren't even
that mean
to me.
Surprisingly nice. I bought you a pan of chocolate. Remember, we're actually friends, Dominic.
I know. I don't know what...
You forget that sometimes.
I don't know what got into you. I think maybe last week's postcard from Europe lulled you into a place of, I don't know, warm generosity.
If you haven't listened yet, we're really proud of last week's show. Friend of the show, Lena Bexillesen, was reporting from inside a maximum security prison in Denmark. And she made this really beautiful and sensitive piece about a big decision that's facing Greenlandic prisoners in there. So check it out if you haven't already. But yeah, it's nice to be back.
Yeah, this week we're going back to our normal format. We'll have a good week, bad week for you, a nice interview, and then a happy ending to round things off. But who are we speaking to this week?
This week we're talking to Dr. Elliot Ross. He's an old friend of ours.
Is he a doctor?
Well, not like a doctor, but like an academic book doctor.
Oh, okay.
And he's also a distinguished football Twitter commentator, which is obviously something that Dominic and I are very proud of. But his actual proper job is covering colonialism for The Correspondent, which is the English version of De Correspondent, a publication that will be well known to our Dutch listeners. The fact that The Correspondent decided to make colonialism a journalistic beat is really fascinating to me. And since Elliot started the job a couple of months ago, he has been writing a lot about how Europe's colonial past is still present in the world that we live in today. We'll be catching up with him about that. But first...
Oh, I've got a commemoration corner.
Oh, go for it.
It's a very quick commemoration, but last Friday saw 200 years since the birth of Mary Ann Evans in a farmhouse in England. Better known by her nom de plume, George Eliot, she would go on to write 7 novels, one of which, Middlemarch, is considered by many to be one of the greatest ever novels to be written in the English language. So happy birthday, Mary / George.
I never finished it.
Didn't you? Yeah, I was going to ask if you had. No. I also haven't read it, and... I remember my dad was reading it for about a year.
Did he ever finish it?
I'm not sure he did. I've heard it's one of those books that kind of grows with you as you age and that you have to like give it a few times. So maybe this is the time, Katie, for us both to dig back into Middlemarch.
That's a fun Christmas project for both of us. Yeah, let's do it.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, George. Can you say happy birthday to dead people?
We just did. It has been a good week for the environment.
Has it?
Well, bear with me. I should, of course, preface this with some real talk. The world is still a hot mess and humans continue to do irreversible damage to the planet. But I think we should celebrate small victories when we see them. And I noticed quite a few this week.
Okay, so a few small-scale things.
A few small-scale and some maybe big-scale things. We'll see.
Okay, I'm listening.
First, EasyJet have decided to become the first major airline in the world to carbon offset every single one of their flights. Their carbon offsetting agreement means that they will be paying around 30 million euros a year to green schemes, such as tree planting programs that are meant to offset the emissions of their jet fuel. I know that it's not a sustainable solution to the pollution from planes, and Greenpeace described the offsetting announcement as a jumbo-sized greenwash.
Yeah, because I was going to say, aren't we just supposed to be taking fewer planes? That would be a better solution, no?
Yes, that would be a better solution. And yeah, offsetting is something, but it still means we're putting all this awful pollution into the atmosphere. So take this news with a strong dose of skepticism. It's not the answer, but I would argue it's a positive step, and more money for green projects is vital.
It is better than doing nothing, I guess.
It is. And as well as this, EasyJet are investing heavily into creating more sustainable forms of flying, including electric planes that they hope will fly between London and Amsterdam from some point in the 2030s.
Oh yeah, we mentioned those. You were going to take a test ride in one.
No, you want to get me killed. But I'm now going to rattle through some other positive environmental headlines that I spotted this week, because there are quite a lot, actually. The Labour Party in the UK put climate at the top of their manifesto. At the time of recording, we haven't seen the Tories' manifesto yet, but the climate crisis has become one of the key issues of the major parties in the UK election. And this was pretty unimaginable 5 years ago, don't you think?
Yep, true. I'd agree with that.
Did you see that the French Parliament voted to reduce tax breaks for companies using palm oil as a biofuel?
I did. Very exciting.
Long overdue. And we had Coldplay announcing a pause in their touring until they can find a way to do it sustainable. I actually think this is completely unimaginable, even just a few years ago, that a major band would have done this.
Although on that front, one of our listeners, Meg Clement, hi Meg, did point out that maybe it's just good news because who wants to hear Coldplay tour anyway?
Ouch.
Mean, but possibly true.
Moving on, the city of Bristol in the UK announced this week that they were proposing a low emission zone in the city, following similar moves from many other European cities. I read an article in Politico about one of the most ambitious climate policies that's been cooked up by the coalition government in Finland. Tobias on our Patreon group flagged up great news from Iceland, where they are doubling their carbon sequestration. Is that how you pronounce it?
What is that?
It's when they permanently bind carbon into basalt rocks. I don't think I should say any more, because as we've known in the past, when I talk about sciencey things, I just get it wrong.
Stop there.
And the European Investment Bank announced this week that it would stop funding fossil fuel projects from 2021.
Cool.
And finally, Katie and I went to Brussels this week to find out how the European Commission works. We'll share with you what we discovered next week, but spoiler alert, I was encouraged that when we asked some people in the know about what the priorities were for the incoming president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, they all said it was the climate and passing a Green New Deal for Europe. And now this isn't news this week, and it will actually be very difficult to create and pass a Green New Deal that achieves what we need it to achieve. But I did stop and think, wow, unlike most national governments in Europe and actually in the world, the EU is actually trying to make dealing with the climate crisis a priority. This huge institution is striving to do something, and whilst many assume they will fail, at least it's top of the agenda. Dare I suggest it, are we seeing somewhat of a paradigm shift around environmental issues? I mean, even the Brexit Party in the UK are fighting for better recycling and billions of trees to be planted. Of course, we could do a much longer section on all the terrible news about the climate from this week alone and about all the hypocrisy of many of these supposedly green actions. But hey, sometimes we just need to celebrate the successes, even if they are only half successes.
I do think all this talk is good, but I also feel like I want to sort of restrain my celebration of good week on this front until we actually do these things rather than just talking about them. Otherwise, it's a bit like when they gave Obama the Nobel Prize to like encourage him to be a good president. The cynic in me is like, let's see if it actually gets transformed into like concrete action.
Yeah, I agree. I just think in the meantime, we have to not get totally depressed into a state of inaction because people feel it's so impossible to change anything. We do have to realize that, yeah, lots of people are fighting for change and some change is happening.
Agreed. And we have to talk about stuff first before doing it. So yeah. Okay, sold. It's a good week.
Who's had a bad week, Katie?
It's been a bad week for a really big fishing company called Samherji, which is based in Iceland, and I'm going to explain why. But first of all, I want to thank listener Powell, who is in Iceland, and gave us a tip-off that we should look into this. It's actually a massive story, and it wasn't really on my radar, so thank you, Powell. We are trying to get someone on the show to talk about this, but we didn't quite manage to pin down the right person yet, so please accept this bad week as a kind of interim measure. But yeah, it's been a bad week for this really big Icelandic fishing company, Samherji, because they have been accused of paying millions of euros worth of bribes so they could catch fish off the coast of Namibia in Southwest Africa and get lots of access to tasty fish that they could sell.
Tasty fish? How do you know it's tasty?
I don't actually know that it's tasty. It's a type of fish called horse mackerel, which I did not know existed. It's not actually really mackerel.
This sounds like really bad marketing considering the horse meat scandal from a few years ago.
So true. And a corruption scandal is also quite bad marketing. Because get this, not only did they pay millions of euros worth of bribes so that they could catch this fish, but they then put the money that they'd made selling all this fish into a tax haven. They put it into a shell company, Oh, didn't even notice there's an unexpected seafood-related pun there. They put the money in a shell company in the Marshall Islands, which are these tiny little islands in the Pacific Ocean. So it's a very mucky story that spans the globe. It goes from Europe to Africa to the Pacific. What does it show? It shows that, A, this company didn't give a shit about the fact that normal Namibian people didn't see a penny of the money that they spent to fish in these waters, and that all the cash went to lining the pockets of these super corrupt officials. And B, it shows that the company was incredibly keen to stash the money that it made from this dodgy scheme, about 60 million euros. It was really keen to put this money in a tax haven, so normal Icelandic people don't benefit from it either. The whole thing came out via documents that were released by WikiLeaks, which were then used for an investigation by a magazine and a TV show. WikiLeaks is calling them the Fish Rot Files, which is quite evocative. So yeah, it's been a bad week for the company and maybe for everyone. But we can take comfort in the fact that there have been consequences for people involved. So the CEO of the company has had to step down. Two Namibian ministers have been sacked. And the Icelandic fishing minister is also facing calls to resign. You could say he's in murky waters. I'm going to stop it with the fishing puns now.
I was expecting you to bring in like a pun about being stuck in the weeds or something.
A bit like that bit in Gravity where Sandra Bullock has like managed to do this whole space adventure and then she finally gets her leg stuck in seaweed. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that.
Spoiler alert for Gravity.
Anyway, we digress.
We digress. I just wanted to say I usually find stories about fishing intrinsically boring, but this one has gripped me. It's pretty juicy and it's definitely worth reading up on. This Icelandic fishing company's antics in Africa smack of neocolonialism, which brings us very neatly onto this week's guest, Elliot Ross. Dominic, tell us who he is.
Elliot Ross is a friend of ours and a journalist at The Correspondent. He is their everyday colonialism correspondent, and he's writing about how colonialism continues to play out in the present, exploring how we as individuals and how society as a whole should reflect on this toxic legacy of colonialism. And we invited him here today to have a discussion about how we should grapple with Europe's colonial history in the public sphere and in the private sphere.
We could explain what he means by everyday colonialism, but maybe we'd better just let him do it.
Commonly, people think that colonialism ended with the end of formal colonial rule, which happened mainly in the middle of the 20th century. And what I'm interested in doing is looking at certain aspects of like contemporary life around the world that continue to be shaped in really meaningful ways by colonialism.
One of the fields in which people talk about colonialism the most these days is in terms of the colonial objects or artifacts that are in European museums. And there's been, particularly in France, a big discussion about how many of these should be returned and how they should be returned to the former colonies that they were taken from. I was wondering, do you ever think there's too much focus on that? And it can feel a bit an easy tokenistic gesture to just discuss returning these objects and then, you know, everything will be fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something to that. I would basically wholeheartedly support the repatriation of objects of cultural significance that were taken during the colonial period or after. But I think sometimes there is a little bit too much weight attached to the ritual of return. And it is good that, you know, they should be returned. And that it feels like that argument is being won. Like last week, there was a sword that the French had taken from an anti-colonial leader in Senegal that was returned to Senegal. And I think that's great. What I've been trying to do in like the story that I put out last week was sort of to direct people away from only thinking about like big, famous, sort of obviously significant artifacts. What I was trying to do was really think about the homes of European colonial officials in particular who returned to England or Germany or France or wherever they were from and took objects with them that bore within them some kind of connection, some kind of meaning, often some kind of narrative about their experience of the colonial world and what they wanted to remember of it. You're talking about like in the hundreds of thousands, certainly, maybe in the millions of colonial officials and settlers and other kinds of people who moved back to Europe in the middle of the 20th century. And so there's this question about like what happens to those objects as they pass between generations. How do generations that inherit those objects, how do they deal with the memories that kind of come with them?
Just to give one example, you wrote about a pith helmet that you saw in a shop window.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that hat, and maybe for our international listeners, explain like what is a pith helmet?
Yeah, the pith helmet is a hat that is designed, was designed in order to give the head of the wearer very strong protection from the sun. And it was kind of popularized, I think, in the 19th century and then worn both by colonial security forces in places like Kenya and other British colonies, but also by settlers. The whole idea behind the pith helmet was essentially a racial medical one. The medical theories of the time were that the nervous system of white people in particular was especially vulnerable to the tropical sun. And the reason I sort of started writing about the pith helmet was that Melania Trump visited Kenya last year, I believe, and she sort of showed up kind of cosplaying an American tourist hat. American, there's a long history of American tourism to Kenya in the colonial period. They're very enamored of it. Theodore Roosevelt went on a big shooting spree, this kind of thing. Melania rocked up and was wearing a pith helmet, and so I was interested to kind of unpick the symbolism that she meant and maybe also the symbolism that she didn't intend.
So that's kind of like a kind of semi-accidental colonial reference in fashion that's kind of uncomfortably coming in. But there are some objects that you discussed that are in people's homes, some even human remains. Like, how is it that people are allowed to hold on to human remains? Surely that's not legal.
Yeah, that's a good question. Even this week, Edinburgh University gave back skulls which had been taken from Sri Lanka in the 19th century to somebody who was representing like the descendants of the people whose skulls had been taken. During the period of like intensive colonization, but also quite late, you have quite an intensive kind of harvesting almost of human body parts, particularly skulls. Part of this is to do with trophy taking. So you display your kind of potency by essentially headhunting. But it sort of gets conflated with the European practice of bringing back samples, botanical specimens or animal specimens. And so because colonized populations, the way that they're racialized is all about dehumanizing them. And so this is part of that. It's part of race science. So you're collecting heads, essentially, or other body parts that can be studied as part of race science, which at the time is a kind of like respectable and well-funded enterprise. Where this reaches into people's homes is partially these are just being taken as souvenirs. So I spoke to somebody who had been doing research about an important figure within the slave trade in Malawi in the 19th century, who had been effectively kind of lynched by the British who were occupying the country and were kind of in competition with this guy, Mlozi. While doing research on this historical figure, he found out that the guy's head had been taken back by a private individual who'd been a mercenary. This guy had taken two heads from a battle that was fought in, I think, 1895, and he'd taken them for the purpose of using them as bookends. This is kind of the culture that we're talking about here, where a lot of the objects that I'm interested in are boring in a way, so quite sort of banal. You know, it's like living room decor, right? So certain kinds of like rugs or furniture or paintings or very often carvings and sculpture. The guy that I spoke to had been trying to get the family to talk to him about it. And then one day he got a parcel in the post and he opened it up and there was a skull inside.
I mean, I guess there's not an obvious... If you inherit one of these objects, there's not an obvious thing to do with it, is there? There's not some central place that you should get in touch with and say, I'd like to repatriate this object. In some cases, you don't even know where the human remain comes from.
Yeah, so every case is different, and some remains will have notes or there'll be provenance of some kind provided. But you're right to point to the lack of a kind of like a central facility or resource that offers people a way of processing in a kind of ordered fashion, items that they may unsure or ambivalent about. As you could understand, there's not a huge appetite to display these objects. If they're going to be on display, then I think quite rightly, the tendency among curators and among the public that would go to see them would be to want these objects to provide context for what is correctly, in my view, seen as essentially an enormous crime or a set of crimes. One of the reasons why I wrote about the pith helmet was because it was just sitting there in the window of a charity shop. Somebody had just given it up, and I was sort of wondering, what kind of future does an object like that have? Is it now going to become a sort of a prop in a play or worn by somebody in costume? Does it simply just become kind of junk?
There's a shop here in Paris that's quite funny. It's called like Colonial Concept, which is...
What does it sell?
It sells like sort of nostalgic colonial era furniture that I guess if you're an expat white French person living in maybe Dakar in the 60s, that's the kind of way your house might be kitted out.
Oh, that's uncomfortable.
It is rather.
I thought it would be selling like, you know, manuals about like divide and rule and like how to expropriate land and this kind of thing.
How to go.
Someone should take that up with the Trading Standards Authority.
I also notice the use of colonialism in when you're booking your holiday, that they'll often say like, oh, come and stay in this colonial style home, as if it's this really wonderful thing.
It is part of the marketing. And what I realized kind of working on the piece was the extent to which like our talking here as like a white European, our ideas of beauty and like luxury have a lot to do with artifacts and styles and decor and buildings that were popular during the colonial period.
But to be fair, lots of that stuff is really beautiful, right? Like the furniture from the time, some of it is really lovely, and the buildings of the time too.
Yeah, and that's a difficult thing to reckon with. Like people tend to kind of like hold onto those objects really tight when they find a sense of like beauty and home and comfort in them. And so it's a difficult thing to then ask them to consider the way, the role that those kinds of objects, how it was connected to systems and structures of dehumanization, oppression.
I guess especially when it's connected to some kind of connection with their parents or their grandparents who they want to feel warmly towards.
And like with the people that I was interviewing, when I spoke to them about them or their parents and their memories of the colonial period, they would talk about it in terms of like specific forms of expertise that their parents had that they'd applied in a colony. And then I would ask them about like the whole system, and there was just a sort of a silence there. They didn't necessarily know how to speak to that based on their own experience.
I'm wondering if the lack of thought that goes into this in general is partly or maybe even like predominantly because like we're not taught to be interested in this part of our history in school, certainly in Britain anyway. Like I've got to say that despite being a product of colonialism myself, like the only reason that I exist is because France colonized Vietnam, and that's how my dad ended up studying here and like meeting my mum. Mm. Even with that kind of personal history myself, I was still really surprised when I first moved here. I moved to a quite African neighborhood of Paris, and it was the first time I'd really come into contact with Francophone West African people. So I was thinking like all the time about France's colonial history as I walked around the streets, mm-hmm. in a way that I never thought about our own country and our own history.
Yeah.
And it really changed my perspective when I went home. I just hadn't spent much time thinking about the way that Britain's colonial history is still present today. And I think part of that is because we didn't learn anything in school about colonialism. Do you see that as a big part of the problem or not really?
I mean, it's a difficult thing to do because to pin down like what really is a national curriculum is quite difficult. These are really, really diffuse things. But I think in general, it would be fair to say that most of us who've come through British education in some way did not really access much at all in terms of concrete, meaningful colonial history. So there are different models of thinking about it. One is amnesia, you know, the country has engaged in a kind of collective forgetting. Paul Gilroy has proposed the model of what he calls post-colonial melancholia. So his understanding is that Britain, but probably also other European societies, are kind of stuck in a perpetual and ineffective like mourning for the lost object of like their colonial possessions. So they don't really know what to do with that loss and how to process it. One heartening thing is that Labour, in their actual manifesto for this election, have promised to do something about this. So there's going to be, if Labour is elected, which at the time of recording feels slightly unlikely. But nonetheless, you know, one of the major political parties in the UK has formally committed to addressing Britain's colonial legacy. And I think that will certainly involve the curriculum and what people learn in school, as well as other ways of attempting to redress and recognise aspects of Britain's colonial experience that have tended to be glossed over or forgotten. Some people are very, very attached to the idea that there's nothing you can do. And that can be for lots of different reasons. Sometimes it's because they want to reject the original premise, which is that there's been an abuse of people's rights that has produced other forms of injustice down the line. Other times people say, this was a long time ago and it was just so awful that there's no way that we can do anything about it now, so we just need to move on. The fact that the kinds of violation that we talk about when we talk about colonial rule have been so profound and so long-lasting, for me, that makes the case stronger to attempt different forms of redress now. And it's interesting to see, you know, which forms of trying to respond to this history, what people find most useful. It's a kind of an open question that I think a lot of people are struggling with right now.
Do you know what I realised, Dominic?
What?
Elliot Ross was my first ever boss as a journalist when we were working at the student newspaper.
Oh my God, at varsity.
Yeah, many moons ago at the student paper.
Wow. And now you're his boss for the day.
Just for the day. Elliot is an excellent person to follow on Twitter, @Elliot_Ross. And you can check out his work at thecorrespondent.com.
Our happy ending this week comes from the Vienna Concert House, where halfway through a concert by the Vienna Symphony Orchestra, an employee in the coat check noticed that a suitcase that had been handed in was vibrating suspiciously. There was a fear that it might be a bomb, so an explosives expert was called. They arrived quickly to scan the suitcase with X-ray equipment, only to discover that the suspicious vibration was, in fact, from a vibrator inside the suitcase. The concert was able to go on as normal, and according to the police statement, the suitcase was handed over as normal back to its owners at the end of the concert, and they were wished a pleasant evening. Happy ending.
I would call that an exceedingly happy ending. You've been told by one reviewer, Dominic, not to talk about opera so much, but we can make an exception here.
There was no opera, it was a concert, and didn't mention any singers.
Very much vibrator focused. That's it for another week. If you miss us between shows, if you miss us, is that a presumptuous thing to say?
Yes.
But I'm going to go with it anyway. If you miss us between shows, you can often find us hanging out on the Facebook group, the secret Facebook group that is dedicated to our Patreon supporters. Patreon is a website where you can chip in as little as $2 a month to help us keep this show going. The newest member of this happy little community is Jennifer Kroenke.
Thank you. Come and join us at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast.
You can also find us on a range of social media websites, which are
Twitter @EuropeansPod, Instagram @EuropeansPodcast, or email us hello@EuropeansPodcast.com. Oh, and check out our newish website, EuropeansPodcast.com. It's really nice, we think. We'll be back next week as normal in your feeds. So hope you are okay waiting until Tuesday.
Stay warm. Wrap up.
Bye.
Bye.